Find, deliver, install.
Well, good morning. This is the Health and Nutrition Program. Eve Prang Plues is here, and Eve has driven up once again, braved the traffic.
Braved the rain.
Braved the rain.
Bands
survived
of it.
The trip. So yeah. The rain was worse than the traffic.
Oh, the traffic's always weird. I mean, these people are just suicidal in these cars.
Last week, Summer was trying to drive up from the Naples, Fort Myers area, and she got caught in that I-75, all six lanes of traffic blocked.
Oh, where the truck
Manatee
went
County.
Over the Manatee River?
Yeah. Terrible. So she didn't make her show. We had to play a recorded show, but you made it. So it's good to see you.
Yeah, I was listening to you on the air saying we're expecting rain between 12 and 4 as I was going through one of the bands where you couldn't see the car in front of you.
I think the bands are really south of the Skyway, and I should have looked more closely, but you're right. I think for those of us lucky ones, north of the Skyway, the rain is going to start hitting this afternoon. But for you
That's
south of the Skyway, you got
to early.
Yeah. So we're going to take a bunch of phone calls today. We're going to take some emails, as we always do. Thanks for tuning in to Eve Prang Plues program. Eve is a licensed clinical nutritionist, and she talks about nutrition. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can also send your email into the studio here, dj@wmnf.org. And I see we've got two emails already.
They're popping with their questions.
Okay,
they're popping with their questions.
So how are you doing? So what are you worried about these days?
I'm worried about soda pop.
Why?
I mean, I have to tell you, I'm worried about soda pop. You know, the New York Times did an expose about a Mexican town, San Cristobal de las Casas.
Oh, that's a famous place. Lots of Americans go there.
And you know, it's gotten to the point that Coke is cheaper than water. And the amount of diabetes that has happened in this community has increased 30% in 3 years. Now, you know, let me just zone in on diabetes here so we don't lose our perspective. We do not have sugar receptors in our eyeballs. We do not have sugar receptors in our kidneys. We do not have sugar receptors in our nerve sheaths. And so where is the biggest danger that happens with diabetes? It is to the eyes, the loss of vision. Second leading cause of blindness that exists. It's to the kidney and the kidney function, which turns around and affects how we think and affects our blood pressure, among other things. To the sheath of our nerves. Neuropathy, you know, we see those ads on television, you know, stepping on fire, walking on, you know, sand spurs, etc. Once those nerves lose that transmission ability, they send mixed messages. You can have numbness, you can have tingling, you can have burning, you can have, you know, stabbing. All of those things are potential with diabetes. I mean, I'm not even going to get into the amputation piece. There's a zip code up in the Bronx in New York that has the highest rate of amputation in the United States. Now, that would not be an award I would want my community to have. Why? Because there's so much diabetes. And diabetes often goes with fatty liver and goes with hypertension and goes with sleep apnea. So now you've got a constellation of things that often run together. And it doesn't really matter where it starts. It's, you know, it starts with high blood pressure and then you end up with apnea and then you get a fatty liver and then you get diabetes. You know, it doesn't matter where you come into that circle. The idea is that, you know, when you have sleep apnea, you have higher risk of stroke and hypertension. Plus, you have fatigue if you're not being treated. So when I see these numbers, when I see the offense that has been created by the federal government, and I'm talking about the federal government of Mexico, because these companies that own the distribution rights for Coca-Cola for both Mexico and most of Latin America, they're independent. You know, they bought the rights to distribute. And they're pulling 300,000 gallons of good water out of the ground every day to use to make their product. But the people of the town are losing water. And so you know, where do you draw the line in terms of the responsibility of the corporation to look out when you've got these kinds of numbers, when between 2013 and 2016, 30% increase in diabetes in this community. The average person in this community is drinking a half a gallon of Coke a day.
Mm.
Now, remember, a can of Coke has about 9 teaspoons of sugar in the form of high fructose corn syrup. Well, if you've got high fructose corn syrup, you've got glyphosate. You've got Roundup as a trickle-down effect that's going to be in some of the corn syrup. You've got phosphoric acid. We already know from the European 10-country 10-year study that phosphoric acid contributes to the destruction of your bones. So it doesn't matter whether it's Coke or Pepsi or RC or root beer, you know, anything that's got phosphoric acid are those dark-colored sodas. That doesn't mean the clear soda is safe. It just says the dark-colored sodas directly contribute to osteoporosis. You know, we've got caramel color. We've got citric acid. We've got other ingredients that are showing up in that Coke. It isn't just the caffeine and the sugar and the caramel color. You know, it's even the bisphenol A that shows up in there. But, you know, if I target anything, it's going to be this 9 teaspoons of sugar. Well, that's in one 12-ounce can. But if you turn it around and you're drinking can after can after can, or half liter after, you know, liter after liter, 2 liters a day, then you're talking about getting, you know, well more than 1,000 and even 2,000 calories per day from high fructose corn syrup.
So when you feel that tingling feeling that you talked about, is that kind of pre-diabetes?
You're talking about in the nerves?
The numbness.
Well, there's other things that can cause neuropathy. Chemo can cause neuropathy. There's certain drugs like Cipro, the antibiotic.
What if you're otherwise healthy and you start to feel the tingling and the numbness?
But again, you could have tingling and numbness from other things. It wouldn't necessarily always be diabetes. There are other things that can cause neuropathy. But the circumstances are, the forward projection of what happens with diabetes is not pretty, no matter where you go. And so a lot of people just believe, oh, I can take this pill. You know, I'll just take this pill and that's going to take care of it. And then 2 years later, they're on 2 pills. And 2 years later, they're on 3 pills and like that. So what I see more often in my private practice is the deterioration of the kidney. We continue to see the kidney not doing as good a job of filtering the trash out of the bloodstream. And when you don't filter the trash out of the bloodstream, that's going to affect your thinking. It's going to affect your cognitive function. It's going to affect your ability just to feel good. So no matter where you come into that arena, what we see is younger and younger and younger people having adult onset diabetes. You know, we can't even call it adult onset diabetes anymore, and juvenile diabetes, et cetera. Now, diabetes type 1 is the diabetes that's an autoimmune disease. And we know this autoimmune disease causes people to have to use insulin injectable for the rest of their lives. And until such time as insulin was available to use, most people that were type 1 diabetics were dead by the time they were 30 years old. Well, we know that giving cow's milk to babies under 1 year old increased the risk of diabetes type 1 14-fold. Not 14%, 14-fold. So it appears that the body makes an antibody toward the cow milk, and that antibody attacks the pancreas and destroys what's called the islets of Langerhans, the place where the insulin is actually produced. But diabetes type 2, or what we used to call adult onset diabetes, we're now finding in children. You know, just a few years ago, we found the first case in a 17-year-old. Now we're finding them in a 9-year-old. And so this isn't a situation where the pancreas is unable to produce insulin. This is a situation where the cell is unable to use the sugar correctly. And you can have an in-between stage that is called hyperinsulinemia. It's not hypoglycemia, where you can't keep your blood sugar regulated in a normal range. It's not diabetes, where the sugar numbers are real high. It's a number where the pancreas is confused, and so it's overproducing insulin. So people eat their dinner, and 20 minutes later, they're asleep. And you've seen those people. They're, you know, they hardly put their fork down, and they're already starting to lose it. And so hyperinsulinemia, too much insulin is being produced because it's trying to drive the sugar into the cell. And hyperinsulinemia will ultimately end up as diabetes. But the nature of the, to me, the maliciousness of having this city where a private company is paying a a royalty to the federal government for permission to take out these 300,000 gallons of water out of the ground, and yet the people in their own town can't get water as cheap as they can buy Coke. That is morally repugnant.
All right, so if you're seeing these early signs of diabetes, how reversible is it?
A lot of it is very reversible in the beginning. When we start seeing these high glucose fasting numbers, or when we measure hemoglobin A1C, hemoglobin A1C, HA1C, is something that, as far as I'm concerned, every adult should have on their blood testing list every year. When you look at 5.7, 5.7 is your barrier. As soon as we get to 5.7 on a hemoglobin A1C, then we're headed toward diabetes. Doesn't mean you're a diabetic, it just means you're on the road. What do we want? We want 5.4s and 5.2s and 5.6s. You know, we want to keep those numbers where we're showing that your sugar regulation over 3 months, because that's what a hemoglobin A1C is. It's not just looking at what is your glucose, you know, the morning they take your blood sample. It's what is your glucose over the last 3 months. So it's a difference between a picture and a video. And when we start seeing that consistent number being high in the sixes, in the sevens, I've seen numbers as high as 11, then we're in a situation where we're destroying eye tissue, we're destroying kidney tissue, and we're destroying nerve tissue. All right, it's as so simple as that.
First step is to get tested. You're listening to Eve Prang Plews on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And we're going to take some phone calls in a little bit. All right, so sorry to interrupt, but so Eve, in addition to getting tested, how do you reverse it? What do you do?
We eat real food. It's simple. We need to eat food that grows out of the ground. We need to eat food that our grandmother would recognize. You know, how much processed food is going into your body.
So give up all those sugary sodas. Give up, I think, fruit juice, because you say fruit juice is just as bad as a sugary soda.
We're getting a blast. And see, people say, oh, well, you put together a can of Coke and a glass of orange juice, the orange juice is better. Yeah, right. Which is better, you know, strychnine or arsenic? You know, the situation is it's just too much sugar for the body to handle at one blast.
I wonder how much sugar couldn't we tolerate a day? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, 100 years ago, we were eating about 6 pounds a year. Now we're eating 153 pounds a year. So if you're not eating a half a pound of sugar every day, and I'm not eating half a pound of sugar every day, somebody's out there drinking a half a gallon of Coke every, you know, and you see where that goes. There are cultural predispositions to certain disease conditions. And we do know that among the First Nation people here of North America, which includes very many of the Native Mexican populations, that we have a predisposition to developing diabetes. I certainly saw it when I was living in Arizona and looking at the Navajos and the Hopis and the Supais and the Wallasupais, et cetera, because their body was never subjected to that. I mean, the sweetest thing that they ever got was a piece of wild fruit. So if the sweetest thing you ever got was a handful of berries or, you know, a crab apple, you know, okay, so every once in a while you found a stash of honey. But that was rare and, you know, limited in terms of what you got. So the body was never designed to handle these big blasts of sugar. So I get people in my practice and they get up in the morning and they put a tablespoon of sugar in their coffee. And then they put, you know, some sort of sweetened, you know, coffee mate, some kind of, you know, hazelnut, cowabunga, something in their coffee. And then they're having, you know, an almond croissant, or they're having a Pop-Tart, or they're having, you know.
What's the right amount of sugar, though? A half pound.
I can't give you a right amount of sugar. And the reason that I can't give you a right amount of sugar.
Everybody's DNA is different.
Well, no, it isn't just about the DNA. It's also about the body size. I can't say one number for a 100-pound woman and a 200-pound man are going to be the same. I also can't say the same thing for somebody who's a desk jockey, who's, you know, then my Florida Power lineman, you know, that's out there working and then has kickboxing as a hobby. So, you know, when people are using large amounts of fuel in terms of their work and their activity, they may use up a good bit of that glucose. But if you're sitting at the desk all day and you're munching and you're drinking these, you know, high volume sugar drinks, whether they're soda pops or they're, you know, energy drinks.
And you would include alcohol in that too.
Of course I'll include alcohol, because right, alcohol is nothing but super sugar.
Yeah.
But the idea of understanding two different pieces of this. One, these multinational companies, and today we're focusing on Coca-Cola, but I can make a list as long as my arm. They don't make money on your health. Health is not profitable to them. We want to understand that big agriculture, big food, big meat, and big pharma are all the children of big chemistry. And so when we look at all of these devaluations of the regulations on big chemistry, they're going to affect all of those things. So, gee, if I feed you this cruddy food, you're going to develop a disease, and then I can sell you this drug that comes out of big pharma. So, you know, if you hear skepticism in my voice, believe me, it didn't happen naturally. I had to be convinced of the fact that these multinational companies were deliberately and knowingly doing things to destroy the health of people all over the world.
Well, you're listening to Eve Praying Plews. We're talking about health and nutrition here on WMNF 88.5 FM. And Eve is here every other Monday at 10 o'clock. She's here for this whole hour. You can send your question in via email. Send it to dj@wmnf.org. Can I start asking you some questions?
Oh, have at it.
So Allegra says, my brother would like to know what supplement or foods naturally regulate sodium levels.
Well, potassium is the dance partner of sodium. So for those people in the audience that are old enough to remember Fred and Ginger dancing together, they dance together, potassium and sodium. So where do you get potassium? You get it from all your fruits and vegetables. It isn't just from bananas. You get it from avocado, and you get it from a baked potato, and you get it from an orange. But these high potassium foods, if we have a lot of fruits and vegetables, they automatically balance out the sodium. Unless, of course, you're eating a meal at one of the chain restaurants that's giving you, you know, literally thousands and thousands of milligrams of sodium. Why do they put thousands of milligrams of sodium in a dish? To cover up poor quality ingredients. So it isn't a matter of, quote, regulating the sodium. First off, stop eating all the processed foods that have these cowabunga high numbers of sodium. And, you know, if you're going to go to a chain restaurant, these chain restaurants that anchor a lot of the mall locations, go to their nutrition site, because if they're a multi-state location, they have to put their nutrition online. And when you look up Mushu pork at one of the popular places and it has 7,900 milligrams of sodium, which is almost 4 teaspoons, you don't have to have a background in biochemistry to know that is not a really good idea. You know, when you go to buy your spaghetti sauce at the grocery store, even I know you're buying organic, but turn them around and look at the amount of sodium in a serving. Look at the amount of sodium in a can of soup. When I was visiting Australia, one of the 3 trips that I made to Australia, Australian government forbade Campbell's from doing the ad, soup is good food. And the reason was because there was so blinking much sodium in a can of Campbell's soup that they could not call it good food. Mm. So we have an ability to regulate our sodium by having lots of fruits and vegetables in the diet.
So we've got emails from Dennis and Kylie and Jordan. We've got calls from Grant, Megan, Carly, Carrie, and Joe. Let's go to Grant in Largo for the first call of the day. Grant, you're on with Eve. What's your question about health and nutrition?
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm 63 years old, and over the years had some athletic injuries to my knee and ankle, and now have a lot of pain, I think from mostly from inflammation and arthritis. And so I changed my diet. I cut out dairy and minimized meat, no sugar, and less coffee, and started juicing with some things like turmeric and ginger. And this is my question. I started drinking green tea, which I really, really enjoy. But I thought I heard Eve say a few weeks ago or a few programs ago that drinking too much green tea can create a problem. So my question is, what are the benefits of green tea? And most importantly, what are the side effects? And are there other foods or teas I can drink to work on this inflammation issue I have?
Grant, two things. First off, I don't recall ever saying that too much green tea is bad. Remember, green tea, oolong tea, and black tea are all the same plant. They're Camellia sinensis. They're a camellia plant. And so black tea is fermented, oolong is partially fermented, and green tea is not fermented at all, and white tea are the tips of the leaves that, you know, have now been popularized, but as far as I'm concerned, do a disservice both to the color white and to the word tea. So when I was in Hong Kong, I was amazed that every taxi driver had a gallon jug of water sitting on their front seat, on their passenger seat. And what they did is they took their big old scoop of green tea and put it in that gallon jug and filled it full of water, boiling water in the morning. And you know, whether it was a quart bottle or a gallon bottle, what would happen is later in the day that would go down and then they would fill it again, but they would use the same tea.
Yeah.
And so each dose of green tea during the day still had the flavor of the Camellia sinensis, but it didn't have as much caffeine. So they took the higher caffeine version in the morning and then less in the afternoon, et cetera. So I personally don't know of any bad news that comes from drinking a lot of green tea. Now, I would comment regarding your knee and ankle pain and the herbs ginger and turmeric. These are two very important anti-inflammatory herbs. The nature of ginger, you can take a piece of ginger root and cut three coins off of it about the thickness of a nickel, put them in two cups of cold water on the stove, bring them to a boil, turn it down to a simmer, put a lid on it and let it simmer for 20 minutes, and you'll have the best ginger tea you ever had, and that's delicious together with your green tea. Next, turmeric. You know, those roots of the turmeric, the bright orange golden roots, fabulous for you to be doing in juicing, but you can't really get a high enough concentration of the curcuminoids, the active ingredients that are in the turmeric, when you're just putting a little knob of it into your juicing. There are companies that actually concentrate the curcuminoids that are part of the turmeric that act as pain relievers. But these two things, turmeric and ginger, are two of the major anti-inflammatory pain relievers. But the other thing that you might look at in terms of your knee and ankle pain is to have an x-ray of those joints and to see whether your pain is coming from bone-on-bone situations where things like hyaluronic acid can make a huge difference. I use a lot of hyaluronic acid in my practice. I have for about 15 years or so. But I didn't realize that I wasn't dosing correctly until I took a training from Dr. Fritz Sutter. And Dr. Sutter explained to me that you have to really load hyaluronic acid in the very beginning. So, you know, I might give you two for breakfast, two for lunch, two for dinner, and two at bedtime for a week until I get that in. Hyaluronic acid increases the synovial fluid in the joint, which is, you know, for want of a better description, the WD-40 of your joint. It's like the oil can. But what it actually can do is if you get that synovium fluffed out, it'll actually pull those bones apart just a little silly millimeter, just enough that one rough surface doesn't bang into another rough surface. And as a result, you get some pain relief. So that might be something else that you would explore, Grant.
I will. And I do. It is bone on bone. I've had surgery on the knee and the cartilage is gone. But I'm trying to avoid a knee replacement because sometimes I get reports that those are really good and sometimes not so good. So,
well, then the other thing, since you already know that I'd add would be glucosamine, and not glucosamine hydrochloride, but glucosamine sulfate. And that in 1,500 milligrams a day, so two 750s, you know, 750 for breakfast, 750 for dinner, or 500 three times a day. I'm not as big a fan of chondroitin because it's a really huge molecule. It isn't very well absorbed. But the glucosamine sulfate, I've seen make a big difference. Give yourself 4 months. Give yourself 4 months on 1,500 milligrams a day because it's going to get as good as it's going to get about at the end of the 4 months. And then you're going to know whether it's going to benefit you or not.
And also add the hyaluronic acid to it.
If it was me, I'd do it.
All right, Grant. Thanks a lot, Grant.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. Eve Prang Plues is here. Mike's question is, thanks for all you do. My 25-year-old nephew has Crohn's disease. Any advice I can give him, Mike in St. Pete?
Don't eat any baker's yeast in any bread, organic, gluten-free, doesn't matter. No baker's yeast. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is baker's yeast, can show up in supplements. It can show up in foods because it's used, if you ever heard of people using nutritional yeast that they sprinkle on their popcorn or they have it in their, you know, bar. But you know, like a protein bar. You can run an antibody test for this particular yeast. Some people that have Crohn's are cross-reactive to yeast, meaning that they react to yeast besides baker's yeast. They may react to brewer's yeast that's going to show up in the beer and the liquor. They may react to the ferment that's in the vinegar, in the salad dressing, in the soy sauce. So in the fermented foods, the sauerkrauts and the pickles and things like that. But absolutely, positively, no baker's yeast in any way, shape, or form, not one slice of bread that has baker's yeast in it. You could use lavash or tortillas or matzahs or crackers, and there is one bread out there that doesn't, there are several breads out there that don't have any yeast. And remember, sourdough is yeast. Even though it doesn't list baker's yeast on the label, sourdough still means that there's yeast in there. So that's my recommendation with Crohn's.
All right. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Carly in St. Pete. Hi, Carly. You're on with Eve. What's your question?
Hey, I wanted to go back to what you were talking about, sodas. My family and I don't drink sodas, and we don't drink juice. We love water. But with that, I sometimes do like just, you know, a little bit of a carbonation every once in a while. So I've been doing carbonated water, but since there's so many out on the market, you know, what are your thoughts on carbonated water? Just to, you know, I sometimes like that little, you know.
Yeah, my husband does too. So I bought him for Christmas one of those CO2 cartridge carbonator gizmos that you get at some of the big kitchen shops. Okay. You know, they cost less than $100, and then you buy the cartridges as you need and you make your own bubble water. And then if you want to flavor it, you know, I mean, there's a million ways you can flavor it. You know, you can put lemon juice in it. You can take the liquid stevias. I don't particularly like the powdered stevias because they contain other ingredients like erythritol and dextrose. But if you get the liquid stevias, there's about a dozen different flavors of liquid stevia, from cinnamon to chocolate to mandarin orange to lemon. And all you need is about one drop a glass. And so you can put that into your bubble water that you made yourself and make a flavor. As far as I'm concerned, people going out and buying these cans of water with flavoring in them, you're going to have more fun setting fire to a $20 bill. I mean, that, you know, I still think the people that own Perrier are holding their sides in France and laughing like hell, thinking, I'm going to sell these silly Americans water. And so, I, you know, again, your bubble water is only as good as your water. Yeah. So, you know, I want you to use quality filtered water in there, because I think everybody should have an absolute 1 micron filter on their kitchen sink at home.
Okay, perfect.
But that's the way to do it, and you'll save yourself a ton of money over time by just making your own bubbles.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, Carly, thanks a lot. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM. Eve Prang Plues is here, and as she always does every other Monday, she's talking about health and nutrition. Bill in St. Pete says, is turmeric efficacious? We already talked about turmeric a little
bit. There are hundreds and hundreds of studies on turmeric. You know, go to PubMed, type in whatever your condition is, inflammation, use the word and turmeric. You know, pain and turmeric, joints and turmeric. You're going to read until I'm back on the air in 2 weeks.
Let's go to Megan in Tampa. Megan, you're on with Eve. What's your question?
Hi, Eve and Rob. I love you guys. Please excuse me. I have a cold right now, and I'm actually feeling really emotional. My daughter is 8 years old, and she's had a headache for the last week and a half. She had a CT scan that looks pretty good. She does have...
She has what that looks pretty good?
A CT scan, a CAT scan.
Okay.
And the beginning of June, she was in the hospital for 3 days. She had arachnoid granulations, which was like a really bad sinus infection that wasn't clearing. And so that was the beginning of June, 3 days, heavy antibiotics. You know, when she got home, I gave her probiotics and things like that. So we went and saw an ENT when her headache came back and had a CT scan. And he feels like it's TMJ. She does have teeth clenched.
I'm going to stop you. Where is the headache? Front, top, temples. Back, left, temples. Right. Temples. Okay, so temples definitely lead to TMJ.
Yes, and initially what put her in the hospital, it was frontal. It was true sinus pain.
Okay.
So she's not having that. She's not having the pain upon changing elevations. It's just in her temples, and it's constant. It's gone down to a 2 in the last week and a half, but it's remained. It's usually at about 5.
And has
5.
She been checked by a dentist for the alignment of her teeth?
Yes. So we went to, I mean, her dentist kind of sloughed off the fact that she's having teeth clenching problems, and I actually went to a TMJ specialist when, you know, the ENT said that he thought it was ENT, or, you know, thought it was TMJ. I went to a specialist for TMJ, and he said her alignment is fine. He thinks that she might have a sleeping problem, like she's not breathing well at night, and so therefore she's clenching down to try to get more air, because she doesn't open her mouth when she's sleeping.
Does she have tonsils?
Yes, and her tonsils look fine.
Okay. All right. Oh, Mom.
Yeah,
I'm reaching out to you, Mom, because there's nothing harder for any mom than seeing their kids suffer.
Yeah. My husband's on the way to a different ENT right now, because I just want a second opinion.
Okay, let me have you stop if you've given me the majority of information, and let me give you some ways to search.
Okay.
Okay. Every headache is a vasodilator or a vasoconstrictor. The blood vessels dilate or the blood vessels constrict.
Yes.
The way that you find out is you use ice.
Right.
If you put ice around the neck or on those temple areas and it makes it feel better in 4 or 5 minutes, then you know it's a vasodilator.
It feels better, but then when I take the ice off, it comes back.
Right, but something is causing her to vasodilate.
Okay.
So whether she's, you know, having, you know, hot stuffed Doritos, or whether she's putting, you know, sauce on her fish tacos, you know, I don't know what's creating her vasodilation, but you got to look at her food.
Yes.
There's something in her food that's causing the vasodilation. Vasodilation doesn't just happen because the body wakes up one morning and goes, oh, I think I'll vasodilate today. Mm-hmm. So if the ice helps only while the ice is on it, then it comes right back as soon as the ice is gone. The vasoconstrictors are caffeine and salt. So caffeine, and caffeine can be given as a medicine. In other words, we're not looking for her to drive into the drive-thru and get a vat full of high test. You can give her coffee by the tablespoon as a treatment.
Oh. Okay.
So, you know, the nature of caffeine, if the ice vasoconstricts, then the caffeine will vasoconstrict. Now, if you put some salt into a little dish, you know, grandma's salt cellar, and she wets her finger and she sticks it down in the salt and then she sucks that salt off her finger, that's also a vasoconstrictor. That's why when people eat really salty meals, they can end up with a headache because they get too blinking much sodium and then they vasoconstrict.
Okay.
So if you have a vasoconstrictor, the ice will make it worse, the caffeine will make it worse, the salt will make it worse.
Gotcha.
If you have a vasoconstrictor, you need to stand in a hot shower, drink ginger tea like we talked to Grant about. You know, we have to do things that cause vasodilation. So no matter what the source is, those things can make a difference. Now, chronic sinusitis, a sinus infection.
Mm-hmm.
You got a $5 definition with arachnoid granulations. But the way that you tell a sinus infection headache from anything else, or a sinus issue, I don't want to use the word infection, because a lot of times when, you know, these things are cultured, there's no infection there. If you take your thumb and forefinger and you squeeze the root of your nose where your glasses bridge would go, if while squeezing, this is just like the ice, while squeezing the headache goes away, then you know it's a sinus headache. And you got to get that crud in there to move.
Yeah.
So again, heat helps that stuff move. You know, there are various things that are mucus thinners that help to get that stuff to move, and then that relieves the sinus headache. But what we've got is sensitivity on vasodilation and vasoconstriction, and until such time as you find that out, you're not going to be able to give your kid the treatment. The recommendation that I would make for an 8-year-old is to take him to a craniosacral therapist, to take her to someone who does neuromuscular, and these are two different specialty trainings for people who are already licensed as massage therapists, craniosacral treatment and neuromuscular treatment. A neuromuscular treatment can go in there and finger on those places on the jaw and on the scalp, because all those muscles attach above the ear.
Yeah.
And find out if we've got hot spots in there and get that stuff loosened up. So good luck to you, Mom.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, Megan, thanks a lot. Big problem there. You're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. And Kylie writes this: I have a question about obstructive sleep apnea. My boyfriend has struggled with what we think is obstructive sleep apnea for almost his whole life. He's got all the symptoms when I look them up: incredibly loud snoring, stops breathing at night, etc. I've been hassling him for years now to get a sleep study done, and he wants to get one done, but they are expensive. We've been looking into a company called Blue Sleep to do an at-home sleep study. He's fearful of doing one in the lab. They're more expensive. Do you know anything about home sleep tests? Would you say they're worth it? His sleep apnea has really taken a toll on our relationship, and we need to figure something out. Also, he doesn't fit the typical sleep apnea characteristics. He's 6'3", about 175 pounds, not overweight. He's a heavy drinker on weekends, though, but eats pretty healthy and regularly exercises.
First off, there is no longer a typical sleep apnea person. They always told us they had to be overweight, they had to be diabetics, they had to be drunks. We, you know, I've found 16 women with sleep apnea in the last couple of years that don't meet any of those criteria. First off, your boyfriend is at risk, at significant risk, at significant risk of stroke, at significant risk of hypertension, at significant risk of dementia if this is not explored. Home sleep studies are called overnight oximetries. And the company delivers to your house usually two devices. One looks like a Star Trek watch with a wire that goes to a device that clips on the end of your index finger. If you've ever had your oxygen level in your blood tested, you've had that little clip on the finger. The thing is, you tape that to your finger and sleep with it at night, and that measures your oxygen levels through the night. And in some of the overnight oximetries, they give you a device that goes around the chest under the breast area, and you put a cannula in your nose, one of those little clear tubes. It's not hooked to a machine, but what it does is it measures the breath going in and out. So an overnight oximetry test is a way that you can determine if somebody needs to go for a full sleep study. But the, quote, heavy drinker on weekends, you know, I don't mean to be a smart mouth when I'm saying this, but, you know, this is the place where you want to buy long-term care insurance and a life insurance policy on the boyfriend, because you don't give me any ideas about the age. But this is really, really risky behavior here when you've got all of these signs that are there and no action is being taken. You know, the first diagnostic that I do is, what the heck is his blood pressure? So, yes, I will endorse an overnight oximetry if it's anything that'll shake, you know, some sense into knowing that this is not something to ignore. If you've ever seen, like I have, a 38-year-old with apnea who had a full-blown stroke as a result of that, you don't want to go down that road.
Mm. Let's go to Harry in Tampa with his question for Eve on 88.5 FM. Harry, you're on. What's your question?
I just need to know, what can males do to promote healthy prostate?
What can males do to promote a healthy prostate?
Yeah.
Don't drink non-real beverages. I mean, start right there.
What do you mean?
You know, we know the prostate is at risk if we have low vitamin D. Okay, so you can test your vitamin D once a year, get your vitamin D up 50, 65. That can definitely give you some protection against prostate cancer. But because the prostate is not directly connected, but energetically connected to the bladder and to the reproductive organs, it is affected by all of the beverages that we consume. So, you know, are we drinking the Coke we talked about earlier? Are we drinking coffee? Are we drinking water? Are we drinking, you know, Red Bulls? Did you hear about that gal that died from drinking all the Red Bulls this weekend? Or one of those drinks. I don't know what it was. But the idea is, you know, your body evolved on water. It didn't evolve on half soy, half mocha lattes. So the more gnarly things that we put through that kidney and bladder, the worse I see prostate function being. The second thing that you can test every year besides your vitamin D is not only your testosterone, but your DHT, your dihydrotestosterone, what testosterone turns into. Because DHT is what inflames the prostate. And some men are just really good at converting testosterone to DHT, and some men aren't. And so there are ways that you can block that. You might have heard of the botanical treatment saw palmetto berries. And so extracts of saw palmetto berries have been demonstrated to block that translation from testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, and that may also benefit individuals.
Okay.
Harry, how's that?
Is coffee considered a good beverage or a bad beverage?
I'm not worried about coffee up to a quart a day.
Okay.
That's 4 8-ounce glasses. I am worried about the fifth cup. Once we get to the fifth 8-ounce cup of coffee, sudden death from cardiac arrhythmias starts to go up pretty considerably.
You drink it black?
However you drink it.
Okay. Well, you shouldn't put sugar in it, though.
But the idea is, you know, when I talk about sugar, I have to look at the whole of the 24 hours. You know, if somebody puts sugar in their tea, but then they're not having all of these other sugar bombs during the day, I don't have the same concern. So whether it's stevia or whether it's honey or whether it's maple syrup or whether it's rice syrup or, you know, I mean, you got lots of ways to sweeten. They're all sugars. No matter what you call them, they're still sugar. And it's the same thing with the creamers. You know, I'm way happier that somebody puts half and half in their coffee than to put in one of these powdered creamers, which are the worst, or some of these flavored creamers that are out there. When you read the label, you know, it sounds like you're reading a label on building materials.
Okay, Harry, thanks a lot for your question. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Polly writes this for Eve. She says, I'm a 55-year-old female, and I'm having a difficult time losing weight. I wake up at 3 in the morning. I go to work. I eat healthily. Oatmeal for breakfast at 6:30, fruit or snack at 9, bag of raw vegetables before 12, workout after work, eat a peanut butter sandwich, 1/2 cup of yogurt, bag of spinach on the way home from work. I eat healthy dinner about 7 p.m., then go to bed about 9. What do you suggest? I'm going for my yearly checkup. Is there any test I should ask for?
Well, the first thing, I totally disagree with the fact that you eat healthy. I don't believe you eat healthy at all. This is the carb bomb. Oatmeal for breakfast. Where's the protein? You know, 4 grams. And that is if you're using real oatmeal. That's not if you're using, you know, cream of paste where you just stir something up and put it in the microwave. You got more carbs for your fruit snack. You got more carbs with your raw veggies. You get a peanut butter sandwich. Oh, whoopee. I got 2 tablespoons of peanut butter, 8 grams of protein, 1/2 cup of yogurt. Again, another 4 grams of protein, a bag of spinach. I hope it's organic because spinach is on the top of the list of pesticide contaminated foods. And I would never have anybody eat a bag of spinach every day. There's too much oxalic acid. It would affect your joints. So I got 12 grams of protein, a couple more with the oatmeal. You don't tell me what it is that you have for your dinner that you eat healthy at 7 o'clock. But if you're doing this whole pattern, you're not only not going to lose weight, you can expect that you'll be out of the clothes that you're in right now pretty soon. You're going to keep gaining. Where is the protein? If you take the oatmeal and you cooked it in soy milk, soy comes from a bean, organic, of course. You would add some protein to your oatmeal. If you turn around and you had your fruit for a snack, I don't know what fruit that is. I don't know if it's 35 grams of carbs in a single banana or if it's 1/2 cup of blueberries. A bag of raw veggies, great. But could I take those raw veggies and dip them into a hummus dip? You know, it's obvious that you're doing a vegetarian choice here, but the situation is you're so protein malnourished, I would expect that if I did a bioelectric impedance analysis on you, that you would have way more proportion of fat than muscles in your body, and that's just going to keep going with this. So, you know, are there any tests that you should ask for? I mean, you know, I can get a list as long as my arm, but the tests are not what are going to change your behavior. What's going to change your behavior is realizing that you're protein malnourished significantly.
Let's go to Patty in Newport Richey. Patty, you're on with Eve Prang Plews, and what's your question about health and nutrition?
Well, I'm calling about my husband. I notice on his tests, every year when we get his blood work, this year his alkaline... Is it phosphatase?
Alkaline phosphatase.
Okay. This year it was 27, which is low, and then last year it was 37. And the doctor said, don't worry about it. Is it something you just don't worry about?
What are the ALT and AST numbers? They should be immediately below the ALK-phos number.
The ALT is 20.
Uh-huh.
And the AST is 18.
Okay. Thyroid function is one of the things that can be looked at.
Okay.
With an alk phos falling that much. And there's actually two alkaline phosphatase. There's an A and a B.
Oh.
One of them affect, these are all liver enzymes along with the AST and the ALT.
Okay.
And, you know, further investigation I think does need to be done because of the dramatic fall in the value of alkaline phosphatase from 37 down to 27. The first thing that I would do would be to run a thyroid panel.
Okay. Okay, will do.
Thanks, Patty.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patty. All right, Scott from Tampa writes, because there's a history of colon cancer in my family, I have a colonoscopy done every 4 years. With my last two colonoscopies, a couple of polyps were removed. What dietary approach does Eve recommend for optimal gut and digestive health? What food or supplements do you recommend too?
Well, the first thing is the level of vitamin D, as I told the caller about the prostate. 2,5-OH vitamin D can be done every year on your annual blood work. And I'm looking for a number between 50 and 65. I'm using that number based on Dr. Michael Hollick's research at Brown. Dr. Hollick is the biggest dog in the vitamin D world. And your range on a 2,5-OH vitamin D is 30 to 165 is your mean. So that's what I'm shooting for. That's number one. Secondly, a very high fiber diet. I mean, we need to be putting out big poops like we used to when we were eating a high-fiber diet. You know, when we look at the fact that 700 laxatives are sold in America today, we know America's constipated, and I wish all 700 laxatives were sold in Washington, D.C. But the nature of this high-fiber diet is what's most important. You don't want to have toxins sitting against the gut wall. So the higher the fiber diet, the better the bowel works, the lower the risk of cancers. We know that there is a direct relationship between colon cancer and processed meat. So hot dogs and lunch meat, the ham, the bacon, you know, the sausages. These are the things that we see that contribute a great deal to higher amounts of colon cancer, as well as excess red meat. And I consider excess red meat any more than two meals a week. As far as supplements are concerned, really high-quality probiotics that contain lactobacillus and bifidobacter. Again, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly out there in terms of probiotics. It isn't necessarily how many strains are in the probiotic. It is more about whether those strains are the ones that we've proved in the human condition are beneficial, like lactobacillus acidophilus, lactobacillus rhamnosus, bifida, et cetera. So using those supplements on a daily basis with a high fiber diet, check your vitamin D and stay away from lunch meat.
Let's go to Jack in Clearwater. Jack, you're on. What's your question about health and nutrition?
I was wondering if the doctor knew any local physicians that could identify skin parasites. I've had trouble finding them. A lot of them are out of that business. I ordered a book from Heinz Melhorn. It's like for medical students to study. It was a little hard to understand, but I think that they're real small skin flukes. They're shaped like cigars, and I got a microscope, and I can see them, and I can bring them out with baby lotion, but I was wanting a final treatment, and I haven't been able to find. I went to two different dermatologists. They don't identify them. That's not their cup of tea. And I called infectious disease control doctors, and they, all of them seem to have, where they no longer identify them, they just treat, and some of them got out of the business completely. So I may just not have called the right one.
And have you done international travel to tropical areas?
No, just right here in the Tampa Bay area.
First off, I am not a doctor. I am licensed by the Florida Board of Medicine as a nutrition counselor, but I am not a physician. You know, my first answer would be go to a dermatologist and get a biopsy. So did these dermatologists do a biopsy?
No, they won't touch them. It seems like across
okay,
the board.
Then I would, then if ID Associates, Infectious Disease Associates, also is not touching them, then I would call the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and ask them for a recommendation of a specialist in tropical tropical topicals. Never used those two words before. But they would be the individuals that could then direct you to the university situation that was doing research on tropicals. I know there's a good bit of that research that goes on at University of Miami, but I don't have a way to direct you into that.
Right.
So, you know, but from my perspective, and this is after a half a dozen trips to Africa, where I've seen parasites that I would prefer that I had never seen, you know, doing a biopsy is the way you get an ID. And so Center for Disease Control would be the source I'd use.
I'm 90-something percent sure they're skin flukes. They're
well, but you know, just finding out who they are doesn't necessarily give them an exit strategy.
Right.
You know, you want to find a way to get them out of the body. And so we got to get an ID on what they are in order to know what to do as a treatment.
Okay.
Good luck.
All right, Jack. Thanks a lot, Jack.
Bye-bye.
Yode writes, will filtering water affect the minerals that come in the water I drink?
If you're using reverse osmosis, yes. Reverse osmosis will remove the majority of the minerals in the water.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. And you are listening to 88.5 FM. Patty's in Sarasota. Hi, Patty, you're on.
Oh, hi. Eve, I had two quick questions. I hope they're quick. You were talking about sweeteners. What's your opinion of coconut sugar or coconut nectar as an alternative sugar?
There's sugar. There's still sugar.
Right, but I'm talking about any value. I had read a lot on it, and supposedly, and I don't know if you know this or you even agree, something about B vitamins. That it carries.
If you have enough sugar, if you have enough coconut, if you have enough honey to be getting B vitamins, you're having too much sugar in honey and coconut.
Okay.
That we're not using them as a source for nutrients. We're using them as a source for sweetening.
No, I know that. I was just trying to think in terms of better than stevia, better than agave as far as processing and, you know, if you're going to use a sweetener.
No, I get this strong-armed by clients all the time when they say, oh, I use honey, I don't use sugar. Wake up and smell the decaf, boys and girls. This is half glucose and half sucrose.
Okay.
And it's half glucose and half sucrose when it's in the sugar bowl, and it's half glucose and half sucrose when it's in the, honey.
Okay, got it. And one last thing, I think it's Mark Hyman at Cleveland Clinic. I know there's a diet, or not a diet, but a way of eating now where people are eating 5 days of low calorie protein, a little protein, good fats, veggies. Women 500 calories 5 days, men 800, and it's supposed to really regulate and help people to kind of lose their weight. So they do it 5 days, and they can eat normally, and they do it 5 days every month. Have you heard of this thing?
First off, I know Mark Hyman. I see Mark Hyman every year at the Institute for Functional Medicine. I'm a big fan of Mark Hyman in general. I am not a fan of this diet. The thing that I want is somebody to make a lifestyle change. If you go on a diet, you go off a diet. And then you often go back to the same habits that got you to have a diet in the first place. What we've learned from the television show, in part and in other sources, of the biggest loser.
You
take those people that have lost 100 pounds and they've done dramatic exercise and, you know, done special diets, etc. They downset their metabolism so much that 1 year after they have finished their course and gotten their blue ribbon on the TV show, they've gained 100 pounds back.
Right.
Because now they have to eat 800 calories less than what they ate before they went on the program because the metabolism has been downset. See, if your body thinks you're starving to death, it downsets the metabolism. And just because you go back on eating, you know, conventionally again, you don't automatically upregulate that metabolism. So that's why I see people, they've been on these human growth hormone diets, and they've done these 500 and 800 calorie diets, and they lose their 25 pounds, and they're so prideful. And I see them 4 months later, and they've already gained back four. And I see them a year later, and now they're 8 pounds heavier than they were when they started it.
Okay.
If I saw it work, I would endorse it. And I'm frankly surprised. I saw Mark Hyman just 6 weeks ago down in in Miami at in Hollywood at the IFM Symposium. And, you know, this doesn't happen to be a diet that I'm familiar with.
You know, I could have mixed him up because I was listening to a million podcasts with my sister in California who listens to a lot of things. So I don't want to, I may be wrong. So I'm sorry I used his name, but there were a couple others and I might have mixed him up. And I didn't know about
okay.
No problem.
Patty, thanks
you.
A lot. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You.
Well, Eve, we're out of time.
Zoom.
Went by so quickly.
Zoom.
So in 2 weeks, you'll be
you'll
back.
You'll see me.
All right. You'll be here.
I'll be here.
All right. Well, Eve Prang Plews is here every other Monday at 10 a.m. She alternates with John Butts in the Sustainable Living Program. Thanks to Frank Knox. He's been our phone producer today. And Eve, have a safe drive back.
I'll do it.
This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. Live.